Designer and filmmaker Saul Bass was a trusted collaborator of directors like Otto Preminger, Alfred Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick, and Martin Scorsese. Bass's film poster designs are among the cinema's most iconic, and his design work outside of film surrounds us all. And yet Saul Bass's name remains relatively unknown today. I'm Charles Horak, and you're listening to On Film. The life and work of Saul Bass has been beautifully rendered in the recent book Saul Bass, A Life in Film and Design by Jennifer Bass and Pat Kirkham. Pat Kirkham is an author of several books about design and designers, and she teaches design history and material culture at Bard Graduate Center in New York. I'm delighted to have Pat Kirkham on the program today. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for speaking with us. You're joining us by phone from your office in New York. But you are a collaborator with Saul and Elaine Bass's daughter, Jennifer Bass, on really, I think, one of the finest books on film I've seen in the last few years. So congratulations on this 424-page monograph on the work of Saul Bass.
Thank you very much. That's a lovely compliment. And I'm sure Jennifer Bass and indeed Elaine Bass will be delighted.
You know, I've been looking at this book for some months now, and I was trying to draw a contemporary analogy to someone who's as central to what our films look like and the design of posters and all sorts of marketing around films. And I just could not come up with anybody today that fills the niche that Saul Bass filled. He died in 1996, I believe, at the age of 75. How would you describe to someone who doesn't know his work, sort of his summation of his approach or aesthetic?
In terms of his approach or aesthetic, it was very much a reductive approach that he would try and distill often very, very complex ideas and emotions into graphics that at one level look simple, but at another level often involve a lot of ambiguities. That was one of his aims. Hmm. At another level, he was always interested in solving the problem of the commission before him. And that's one of the reasons that his film titles and his posters often look quite different from one another, particularly the film titles, because the films that he was introducing in 2 or 3 minutes were quite different from one another.
You know, we're talking about a visual master of the 20th century on the radio, and maybe it'd be helpful to orient our listeners that, you know, who may not know the name today of Saul Bass, but surely know his work if they've ever seen the opening titles of Psycho or West Side Story or Goodfellas or posters like Schindler's List or, I guess, Anatomy of a Murder or The Shining. Even the amazing logos he did later in life for AT&T, the Girl Scouts, United Airlines. I would say most people listening or everyone listening has seen Saul Bass's work. And one of the amazing things to me, looking at a complete retrospective of his career that you've put together in this amazing book, is that a lot of this work was done in the 50s and 60s and is still vibrant and undated today.
I think, in a way, that's the power of the reductive imagery. Mm. If you think of the symbol for a film about a jazz drummer with drug addiction, Frank Sinatra in Man with a Golden Arm, 1955, mm-hmm. you have this black arm, a petrified arm.
Right.
And that, at the time, was a very edgy thing to do. Today, drug addiction is much more in the public discourse. Nonetheless, it's still that very powerful image. And actually, it's the one Saul himself had chosen to be on the cover of a book he was hoping to write, and we respected that.
And it's on the cover of your book.
Yes. The other ones I'm thinking of was the film Bonjour Tristesse, 1958, you know, Hello Sadness, in a way. This is a wonderful kind of haiku-like image, which is basically starts with an eye and a teardrop. The poster actually has eyes, eyebrows, nose, and a mouth, and a teardrop. The newspaper advertising simply often has the eye and a teardrop.
But
that in itself is telling you that something is happening, where there is a tinge of sadness in it. And in the beautiful Technicolor opening sequence, these wonderful abstract petal shapes eventually form into a teardrop. So you have this kind of lovely innocence of the youthfulness of the girl in the film, but the sadness that descends upon her is evoked in the teardrop.
I'm thinking of the amazing summation of the title sequence in Vertigo as well, the vortexes and the spirals and the eyes and the faces, and it's all a film about watching and falling and descending and being swept up in obsession.
Also, that's a wonderfully visual sequence, but it's also very visceral. Your stomach begins to move as these spirals, you know, really kind of move and twist in space. And I think it's no coincidence that this is just after the first Russian manned spacecraft.
Mm.
And that's very much around. Saul had been interested in those particular forms, they're called Lissajou forms, since the 1940s, and he'd often thought of ways to use them, and here was this perfect way of using it. And those spiraling forms, in fact, are in the middle of a sequence that he hoped would give that sensation of vertigo, but they're also bookended by the camera really exploring the face of a woman. You know, this the whole film's about the constructed nature of femininity and this woman's identity. And so it begins and ends with that, and then this very dramatic thing of as the camera goes into the eyeball, really, the director credit for Hitchcock pops out of it.
Right. The all-seeing Hitchcock.
Yes.
He, of course, grew up in New York, and his early career was in the late 30s, early 40s in New York in advertising. I guess he was fortunate in that his early career found him in agencies that worked on film campaigns, if not posters, at least the print marketing for films. And so from the very beginning, it seems that his modernist approach or his interest in avant-garde art in the 30s began to work its way into film advertising.
We don't really have any evidence of what he was producing really in the 30s and 40s, and I know if Saul was answering this, he would just be laughing because he got a job, and he was delighted to get one during the Depression when he left school at 16 in advertising. It was what he wanted to do, and he was very interested in film, and so he was thrilled to get a job in an agency that had commissions to do film advertising, but that was trade advertising,
yes.
What he called the ass end of the trade, the bottom of the bottom. That didn't bother him. But he became very frustrated when, in fact, they weren't very interested in what he thought were his grand ideas about how to improve.
But these were formative years where he was absorbing a lot of New York culture and cutting-edge artists and schooling himself. And then I guess it was being whisked off to Hollywood, if you will, in 46 with an ad agency that... was he just in the right place at the right time as films were changing after the war? And
I think that's an important part of it, this rise of the independent producers and directors. Mm. And interestingly, New York had remained the center for film advertising and did so actually way into the 50s, whereas Hollywood was the center of production. And it was simply because Madison Avenue and the advertising business were so strongly structured in New York. But by 45, you know, the end of the war and that post-war period, you saw that shift in agencies beginning to go where the work was and these new types of agencies. And it was very interesting to me that a lot of producers and directors of what at the time were called adult films such as Man with a Golden Arm with slightly controversial content, slightly, you know, social commentary films, often by people with very liberal or left politics. They were people who were very interested in what Saul was doing. He had, you know, left and then liberal politics. A very, very intellectual approach to life as well as a very visual one. He had a fantastic sense of humor, and you get this all feeding into his designs, and particularly from, I would say, from about 44 till the early 50s, he was very influenced by European modernist designers who were working in the US, who had come from Europe in the 30s. But he doesn't really get into that in any systematic sort of way until the 1940s, when he starts to study, you know, just evening classes at Brooklyn College, but with Georgi Kepesh, who was one of the great kind of modernists, hardline modernists of the period.
You mentioned,
it seems, however, that he reached a more comfortable style of his own when he set aside that rather formulaic modernism and let his own interest in earlier posters, the bold mm-hmm. posters of, you know, Germany in the early 20th century, and the emotional and psychological aspects of design flow much more into his work.
And he has to collaborate with other artists, directors with a vision themselves and for a film, and sum that up. You had mentioned, described his work as reductive, and I'm thinking, you know, from a design point of view, while these images may seem so simple, they were very hard to arrive at. He was a constant sketcher, I know, from reading your book, and there were so many iterations that he went through to arrive at just the right imagery, whether it was for a poster or a title sequence or a corporate logo. And I'm wondering, do you have any sense of at what point he knew he had the image he was looking for? Was it just pure intuition on his part when he arrived at the correct resolution?
I'm reminded of a comment Charles Eames made when somebody asked him about the form of one of the chairs emanating from him and his wife, Ray, in the Eames office. He said, yeah, 30 years of intuition, 30 years of really hard work and learning, you know, on the job. And I think that's the sort of answer Saul would probably have given, that, you know, you do get a certain sense. But yes, each job he regarded as, you know, starting over again, that he didn't want to feel he was just reworking some vocabulary, although that's almost inevitable, I think.
But each one is different.
You can draw on that, but that he would just start and say, that was the scary part, you know, the blank page. And actually in his office, he only ever had blank sheets of paper, beautifully sharpened pencil, and, you know, that was it. And other designers have told me that they would never have the time or the interest to do as many as 300, sometimes 400, you know, working sketches, elaborate the ideas, talk them through, develop them. I don't know if you've seen or read about some of the recent sketches for The Shining, for the publicity for The Shining, that have recently come to light. And there's a really interesting dialogue, because Kubrick, perhaps the most critical of yes. all the directors at every level in terms of collaboration, he's making comments to Saul saying, well, I really don't like this, this is not working for me. And it's, you know, back to the drawing board. Generally, however, a lot of directors, I think, were very taken with his with his work. And by the end of his career, one of the amazing things about Scorsese was the huge level of trust that Scorsese put in Bass. And actually, by then, we're talking about Saul and Elaine Bass, because from 1960, the film titles and a series of short films were very much in collaboration with his wife, Elaine.
Who was a great collaborator.
Yes, yes. And so Scorsese, in a way, handed over the opening of his films, as did all these directors, to someone whose energy and visual ideas that they liked very much. But then there was a collaboration to achieve that. Scorsese said Saul and Elaine very often got it on the first or the second time, that the ideas were so good that were coming out of them, you know, in the early 90s. They were almost there straight away by the time he was meeting with them to talk over the thing. And I think he's one of the people today who is one of the greatest promoters of their film heritage.
And, of course, a great cinephile himself and student
Absolutely.
Of the cinema. So
Absolutely.
I'm wondering that, you know, this ability to find the irreducible image and all of this work in title sequences, it's fascinating that some of these directors gave him a little more leeway. For instance, Alfred Hitchcock, many people would perhaps be surprised today to know that Saul Bass created the shower sequence, or at least storyboarded it and was present in its making. Someone like Alfred Hitchcock giving that kind of responsibility away to someone like Saul Bass, it must have been an amazingly respectful approach to that scene.
I think Hitchcock, of course, had come out of graphics himself, and we know that he regularly read graphic journals and things, so I think he knew that there was this young rising graphic star before he brought him in, and the first one was for Vertigo, and then the following year he had him do titles again for North by Northwest. Then in 1960 he has this very cheap movie that's complicated, and he knows it's going to discombobulate people because the heroine's got it killed off 45 minutes into it, and he knows he has some difficult things to get over. And of course he has this one scene, and he decides that he's going to bring Saul in on that. And Saul was involved in the discussions right from the beginning of that movie. Often if you do titles, you're brought in at the end, and often designers don't like that because they feel they do their best work if they've seen the film evolve. Anyway, he's brought in. Each version of the script goes to him, so he's very integrated into that. But of course Hitchcock had also brought in Salvador Dali in earlier years, and actually there's a short sequence in Vertigo that is created by an artist called John Ferran.
Yes.
And to me it looks quite crude in comparison to the film titles, and I think that was not lost on Hitchcock. So instead of him bringing in someone like Ferran or Dali, who are artists, to create arty scenes, as it were, he had this notion of bringing in this young graphic person with whom he already had an established collaborative relationship.
I think that the first time I saw the name, or at least acknowledged the name of Saul Bass, it was watching on television in the mid-70s the only feature film that he directed, Phase 4, which is still a personal favorite of mine, but that sort of opened the door to me of just who this person was. I'm wondering if there was a moment in your life where you hearken back to sitting up and thinking, you know, I need to find out who made that image.
That's certainly the case with my husband, who's just slightly older than I am, because he is a 14-year-old, went to see a film about a jazz drummer, and then was absolutely blown away by this title sequence for Man with a Golden Arm, and hadn't realized that, you know, art could be these abstract forms, and actually went on to be an abstract sculptor and printmaker. Interestingly, one of his very good friends, someone he played in a band with at the same time, Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones, also tells me the same story, the same age 14. They go to see a film because they hear it's about jazz. And then what blows them away is this amazing graphics. Charlie went on to work in a graphic design agency, and he said, you know, these images were still in his mind, but it wasn't until Anatomy of a Murder in 59 that the name connected.
Interesting.
And also that's because American graphic designers who knew Bass were also in London and working in the big agencies by then, and talking and putting a name to those images. My kind of entry, certainly in terms of Psycho, is very strange, because in the 1960s there was so much hype about that film that I only went on the condition that my boyfriend told me when it was going to come on, or, you know, I knew I was going to close my eyes before I even went into the cinema. So I just watched that scene with closed eyes. Wasn't at that stage particularly fond of so-called horror movies or anything, so didn't see it until a colleague was teaching a film class, and he was interested in new ways of thinking about, you know, affectivity in film, and so we were all required to write down what our gut feelings were when we were watching this clip, which turned out to be just the shower sequence. We didn't know what it was. The students and other faculty in the class, this sort of workshop, we didn't know what it was. So I'm watching this and I'm thinking, I'm sure this isn't what my colleague Michael wants me to say, but I'm just seeing modernist design here. Wow, you know, and I was making notes like this. Then at the end of the sequence, my colleague was trying to draw out some students who were being a bit reluctant to speak, and he then said, well, what do you think? So I said, oh, my goodness, you know, I'm just so blown away by these modernist graphics. My head's just whirring around that. And he said, oh, well, that wasn't really what I wanted you to say. I wanted you to talk about, you know, the vaginal imagery or something. And by then, the whole class was laughing about what my colleague was trying to do, when another colleague intervened and said, well, she's absolutely right, because this is Saul Bass. And I went, oh, yes, I have to find out more about this. So that was my kind of entry. And maybe 5 years later, the British Film Institute magazine called Sight and Sound called me up and said, would you like to write about Saul Bass? And, you know, that was a great moment for me, because by then he had moved into titles again, and I got to know him and to know Elaine by writing about their move back into title design in the late 80s and early 90s. So that was from that moment of this odd workshop in my university, you know, that led eventually to meeting and becoming friends with them.
Well, it's an extraordinary book, and you've certainly put the name back to the images befitting Saul Bass. So I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak to us today.
Thank you, Charles. It was a great, great pleasure.
I've been discussing the life and work of iconic designer and filmmaker Saul Bass with Pat Kirkham, collaborator with Jennifer Bass on the book Saul Bass, A Life in Film and Design. At 424 pages, the book is a rich exploration of Bass's work, including his commercial art beginnings, film poster designs, imaginative title sequences for many classic films, his own personal film experiments, and his lasting design of corporate logos that still surround us. Saul Bass, A Life in Film and Design is available online from all the usual booksellers. On Film's producer is Norma Martinez. I'm Charles Horak. Thank you for listening to On Film.